Any questions on things we talked about in the first hour there? One thing I do want to mention, I mentioned anaplastic carcinoma of the thyroid is blessedly very uncommon, but also probably the most lethal cancer in all of the human, all the malignancies that we have tonight. We literally measure survival in days, and that's it. Typically it's 6 weeks from the point of discovery. It's an unbelievably aggressive and rapidly growing, and we have absolutely nothing to fix it. Anaplastic carcinoma of the thyroid probably arises in an existing cancer, and one cell becomes extremely hypermalignant, accumulates other mutations, and makes it extremely aggressive, rapidly growing. So anaplastic carcinoma, whereas the others I mentioned, I don't want to imply they're trivial, but they are quite curable, amenable to treatment. But anaplastic carcinoma is not. There is nothing to do except do the initial surgery and say what you do is you go home and you get your get things in order now because you probably got a month to live. It's the most rapidly growing aggressive tumor I've ever had any involvement with. All right, let's go ahead and take a look now at inflammatory conditions. And now we're going to come back to some of the systems that we've already talked about because we're going to see that autoimmune destruction plays a very important role. So when we talk about inflammation, maybe the first thing that comes to mind would be a zit on the end of your nose, just exactly where you don't want it. At the time you don't want it, you know, this thing would be very big out here, and you try to come up with a Band-Aid or something to put over it, and it would get big and red, and it would drain. That's the last thing. Well, that's a bacterial infection, and yes, you can have bacterial involvement of the glands. We'll talk about one in particular, the adrenal gland. Viral infections do occur, probably occur fairly frequently in the thyroid, but we get over them. And most times, other than having had flu-like symptoms, maybe a little anterior neck pain, but they don't tend to cause us a long-term problem. Some can. But autoimmune destruction is a different matter. And the question is, how do you get that started? And one of the most important things to remember about an autoimmune disease is that the problem is not with the gland. Yes, the gland is involved. The gland is being destroyed. Your thyroid, in this case, Hashimoto's, is being completely destroyed. But the underlying problem, the real problem, is the immune system. The real problem is what we refer to as immune intolerance. And that is that it doesn't know the thyroid is not part of us. Anybody who has one immunologic disease like this is at risk for others. This is the same kind of person who has destruction of the thyroid gland, which is being depicted here, who will also may well destroy their adrenal gland in the same manner. They may develop rheumatoid arthritis. They may have a whole host of problems related to the fact that the immune system isn't clear on what's us and what's not us. So the actual underlying problem of Hashimoto's disease, which is this, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, is one of immune intolerance. Well, its focus right now is on the thyroid gland, and I can guarantee you, if your immune system decides it wants to destroy your thyroid gland, it's not going to take long. It will do it. It will have the job done. We see a whole host of antibodies produced against it. It's a combined T and B cell event. It's seen more frequently in women than men. It's about 5-1, as I know here. The ultimate upshot will be scarring the thyroid. The thyroid is gone. And now clinical symptoms will become, down the road, will become hypothyroid. And in fact, when we see an elderly, middle-aged or elderly person with hypothyroidism, that rubric, that classification where they've got all the stigmata, cold intolerance and the photophobia and all that, the most common cause is this right here. And that is Hashimoto's thyroiditis that destroys their thyroid gland. We'll even see thyroid tissue within the gland itself, we'll see a lymphatic tissue within the gland itself, active germinal center formation. They make a whole host of antibodies against thyroid cells. There's T cell activation, it's a combined thing. As I mentioned, one autoimmune disease, please keep in mind, one autoimmune disease means you're at risk for others. PA here is not a physician's assistant. It doesn't mean you're heading off towards that, which is probably, I don't think they're pathological, actually. I think they've been both. For a long time, my doc was a physician's assistant. And I'm a doc. That means that's pernicious anemia. What does the word pernicious mean? You may know that pernicious anemia is a B12 deficiency in which we make antibodies against parts of the stomach that produces the binding protein for B12. And so these people are at risk of pernicious anemia. Well, it's pretty, it doesn't, pernicious doesn't mean anything about the default. If someone were to speak to you as being pernicious, would that be something that's good about you? Interesting. Mm-hmm. Someone who's pernicious is sneaking behind, doing things behind the scenes, you know. They're mean, they have mean intentions. Pernicious is not a good term. Well, pernicious anemia, though, is something that creeps up, that sneaks up on you. And lupus erythematosus, Addison's disease, we'll talk about shortly, or other ones. Here's an example of the thyroid. I'm hard-pressed to say that's thyroid. In fact, I was looking at my picture in the notes, here, that I'm the only one apparently in the room that has, and I'm looking at that picture, and I thought, what in the hell is that? You know, I couldn't tell it. Well, it doesn't, that's supposed to be thyroid, excuse me? Well, of course, the thyroid is totally overrun with lymphocytes. It's a combined T B cell attack on it, and this is the only remnant of thyroid tissue here, and that's going to be gone shortly anyway. So it's very thorough about it, and a person develops hypothyroidism down the road. Now, there's another kind. There are other kinds of inflammation within the thyroid. As I mentioned, you can have viral thyroiditis, and that's not uncommon. Here's an example we call decor veins or giant cell thyroiditis. We can see giant cells. That's what these are right here. Kind of like we see with tuberculosis, but that's not TB, okay? This is probably a viral stimulating thing, and this person will likely get over it. Once again, probably in most we see in women more than men, probably a viral trigger, and for a short while there's a self-limited, maybe autoimmune, maybe not, sort of thing. Person has a swollen neck and painful neck, and it might actually be transient, a little hyperthyroid, because as the gland is kind of getting beat up, there's excessive release, leakage almost. But most of the people will recover from this, and later on we have no idea what happened. But and they're not hypothyroid, unlike autoimmune disease of Hashimoto's, where the destruction is complete and total. Here it's just a transient nuisance, and things are going to come back okay. All right, other kinds of infection that might involve the thyroid gland, you can have bacteria and stuff. I mentioned that before. We occasionally see that. Given the fact that there's a lot of vascularity in the thyroid gland, you might think it would be a spot where metastatic malignancies might go, but that's extremely unusual. Other cancers, you know, like kidney cancer or breast or even melanoma or something like that, thyroid is extremely vascularized. You might think that tumors would metastasize there. I've seen one. I was in practice for 21 years. I saw one case of that. It was breast cancer. That was it. So, tumors don't find the thyroid, metastatic tumors don't find the thyroid very hospitable. Let's take a look at parathyroid. Most of us have four parathyroids, each is about the size of a very small jelly bean, and they're sort of positioned at the points of the thyroid gland, point of the, you might say, the axis, north-south axis of the thyroid gland. Two on either side, makes parathyroid, mobilizes calcium, and so forth, and there's a connection here between calcium and phosphate. We talked about that in the kidney thing. High serum phosphates will drive the calcium down, which will trigger release of more parathyroid. Now, the parathyroid glands are, they can be stimulated to the point where they make so much parathyroid that they become autonomously functioning. They never really go back to what was the normal or healthy condition. So this is an example here when we take a look at excess thyroid function on the basis of high serum phosphates. See, if you have failing kidneys, you can't clear phosphate. You can't pee it out. We pee it out as phosphoric acid. And if you have bad kidneys or no kidneys, you can't get rid of phosphates. And as the phosphoric acid develops, the phosphates develop in the bloodstream, that drives the calcium down. And that makes the parathyroid work extra hard and liberate calcium to try and bring it back up. Well, eventually those parathyroids say, well, this must be the new level we're supposed to seek right here. And so they make so much, they become hyperplastic. And let's say later on, the person gets a transplant, kidney transplant, they're on dialysis, everything is fine, phosphoric acid is gone, parathyroids don't care. They've already reset themselves at this new level and they continue to function autonomously at this higher level. No other gland I know of does that. Well, okay, that would be just an example. So hyperparathyroidism, most of the times is due to isolated adenoma, just occurs once. And it's not part of some other situation. So about 80% of the time, it's one, the gland that develops a little tumor, an eye tumor, that produces parathyroid hormone. And we have all this extra calcium. And people that have high serum calciums want to get real sleepy and attundant. It's probably the way you're feeling right now. All right, and if it gets to be very high, you go to sleep and die. You go into a coma. If you have high serum calcium, you have kidney stones, lots of kidney stones, things like that happen. In fact, there's a little mantra that goes through stones, bones, abdominal groans, and psychic moans. Stones meaning kidney stones. We wash away our bones from the high parathyroid, liberate all that calcium. We have a lot of cramping in the GI tract, and people do get depressed. That's one of the things we always look at. What's the calcium level? When we see somebody with endogenous depression, and that'd be especially the case if they really are kind of sleepy and sort of screwy that way. Other reasons for having excessive parathyroid hormone release might be hyperplasia, might be parathyroid cancer. I've never actually seen a parathyroid cancer. It says less than 5%. I'd vote for that. But at any rate, those might be autonomously functioning. I saw plenty of these guys right here as pathologists that were through parathyroids and taken out. The bone wasting can be very profound. It can be generalized, or it can be in cystic areas where you drive those osteoclasts totally bonkers. Remember, the osteoclasts are the guys that are going to release the calcium from the bone. Normally, they do it in a controlled fashion, but in this case, of course, they're being driven crazy by the high serum parathyroid levels. So this would be hyperparathyroidism in a nutshell. We make the distinction between primary hyperparathyroidism. Here's an example of a parathyroid adenoma. And you can see the rest of the gland out here. You can see this kind of tumor right in through here. Cells are quite small. They look like little lymphocytes with a little more cytoplasm. Sometimes they arrange themselves in little rosettes like that. You can see kind of a string-like or maybe some secondary organization in the tumor itself. Normally the parathyroid is about 50-50 fat and meat, you might say. One time I was curious about something. I saw there was an advertisement for a burger joint here in town that advertised that 100% beef in the burgers. These were little square burgers with holes in them and lots of onions, and that's why I like those little things. All right, so at any rate, you know what I'm talking about, okay? And I was just curious, were they really, and I wasn't real interested in going to that particular establishment, but they said 100% beef, and I thought, hell, that can mean anything. Kidneys, guts, eyeballs, hair, the works, you know? You grind it all up, put it in there, who's going to know? Like making hot dogs, Lord only knows what's in those hot dogs. So I drove through and I said, all right, can I get a frozen burger? Don't cook it, I want a raw burger for my dog. And I took it back to the lab, I put it in the form when we made sections, and I looked at it, I said, I don't know what kidney looks like, I'm gonna know spleen, I'll know liver, I'll know what eyeball, retina looks like. Well, my God, that burger was roughly 50% fat and 50% skeletal muscle. My next stop was to drive right back through and get a little sack of those rascals. You know, yes, sir. I'm okay with it. Well, normal functioning parathyroid is about 50% fat and 50% meat, 50% actual endocrine tissue and 50% fat. And so that plays into our evaluation of one, particularly if we see a situation where, for whatever reason, there's hyperplasia of those. Because we may not have a discrete mass such as we see here. If I get something like that, I can say, okay, that was the adenoma, I think we're home free. And we can do parathyroid levels in the blood very quickly. Parathyroid hormone lasts about 15 minutes. Well, actually, it doesn't even last that long. So they take that out. I say, why don't you just cool your jets for a few minutes, send us over a blood sample, we'll test the parathyroid level in the blood, and if it's come down, I know we're done. And if it hasn't come down, I know there's still something to be looked for. So at any rate, the 50% fat and meat thing has to do with if it's hyperplasia. And that would be the case of people who have failing kidneys. Hyperplasia, can't get rid of the phosphoric acid. All parathyroid glands respond the same. The issue there is, what do? Well, you take out three of the four and you leave one of them that will function for the person. So secondary, that's what secondary hyperparathyroidism is. Secondary means that it's occurring as a consequence of something else as opposed to a tumor where it's just growing and making itself. And this would be an example of what I just talked about right here. And sometimes, again, as I mentioned, those glands reset themselves to a higher level of activity and they never change. Now, hypoparathyroidism is kind of interesting. Autoimmune destruction is probably the most common thing that occurs that's metabolic or something that happens to us without plan. But actually, the most common cause of hypoparathyroidism today is accidental removal when you take out the thyroid. And so they take it out, and it's kind of, if you have a big thyroid, it's all kind of folded up in there, and you can take out the thyroid, and the surgeons do look for it. They'll go over, believe it or not, they'll take that thyroid. Every thyroid I ever got was all hacked out by the surgeon in the room. They take the thyroid out, they'll go over it, and they'll slice it all up to see if they have a pair of thyroids, and if they do, they'll stick them back in. And by God, they'll take right off again. Well, they're kind of injured, it takes them a couple of days to kind of figure it out, but they'll take off and go again. But the most common cause of hypoparathyroidism is accidental removal of thyroid, seen here. Autoimmune destruction would be a thing that you would associate with something that happens out of blue. Less frequently congenital absence, but then you've got problems with branchial cleft formation. That's pretty obvious in kind of blue. One of the interesting things that we see with hypo, with low thyroid, or with low calcium levels, rather, will be extreme neuromuscular irritability. Tap them someplace and they almost have a seizure, and they develop cataracts. And a cataract, as you might know, is not a pacification or calcification of the lens. That's kind of a common misconception. Cataract occurs because the lens proteins crystallize. And in order to keep them in suspension so that it's movable, so the lens can be adjusted, you have to have a certain high level of calcium to keep them all kind of in suspension. The calcium drops, the lens proteins will crystallize, and you may never get them back in solution. So cataracts can occur, but we can see a variety of things related to neuromuscular activity. Remember, calcium is a very important intracellular ion, especially with muscle contraction and nerve function. Okay. Move on to adrenal gland. The adrenal gland is two glands in one, and it gets constructed in a manner somewhat similar to the way the thyroid does. The thyroid, part of it comes from endoderm, comes from GI derivatives, and part of it migrates in, and the same thing goes on here, although, frankly, I'm not quite sure where the adrenal cortex comes from. Most of the issues we're going to talk about here are adrenal cortical in nature. And we have, of course, three layers. The other part of the adrenal gland, of course, is the medulla. And the medulla comes from neurocrest derivative cells. And it's going to release epinephrine and norepinephrine on demand. Frankly, we do pretty well without that. If we ever have to remove the adrenal glands, we don't ever really replace epinephrine and norepinephrine. But we can easily replace the glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids. So it's two glands in one. Looking at the cortex, we've got three layers: zona glomerulosa, fasciculata, and reticularis. And it's salt sugar sacs. That's the order in that: zona glomerulosa, fasciculata, reticularis. And part of that, of course, is under control of the pituitary. Part of it is not. Right? The production in the fasciculata, glucocorticoids, is under control of the pituitary through ACTH. The zona glomerulosa, which produces aldosterone, is under production, is under control of what? What does aldosterone do? He said it was a possible conflict. Well, zona glomerulosa produces aldosterone, which would be part of that renin-angiotensin sort of cycle, and ultimately it's involved in sodium retention in the urine and expanding the vascular volume. And we're swapping ions for ions. We have aldosterone. What we're doing is we're picking back sodium, and we're getting rid of some other positive ion, either potassium, calcium, or hydrogen. And of course, the zona reticularis is actually not under control. You might think, well, that's estrogen and testosterone. Maybe that's under control of food. They're actually not. The reproductive organs are. Okay, so the fasciculata is under control of the pituitary in terms of release of glucocorticoids. Once again, too much, too little in space-occupying lesions. Well, tumors are hard to see, can't really palpate those rascals, They do occasionally come up with as incidental findings when we do some kind of abdominal ultrasound or x-ray or whatever. Tumors, in this case, might well be functional. They may be autonomously functioning. Here's an example of Cushing's syndrome. And again, it's a syndrome. It's not a diagnosis. It's just like hyperthyroidism, it's Cushing's. Cushing's syndrome. There is a Cushing's disease that is a subset of Cushing's syndrome. But Cushing's syndrome is this whole collection of findings here. Moon face, buffalo hump, conversion of your skeletal muscle basically into fat, becoming this right here. Weakness of the dermal connective tissue because of the collagen that also gets recycled. You're looking for gluconeogenic amino acids in there. Osteoporosis, fractures, and so forth. And this is all part of that whole syndrome of Cushing's syndrome. The most common cause of Cushing's syndrome, what do you think that is? In the United States, we do it to people. We put them on steroids. We put them on glucocorticoids. By far and away, the most common cause is somebody looking like this. And a person has to be made aware. It will be transient, presumably. Unfortunately, however, the person who develops bad osteoporosis and has a spine like that, that's not probably ever going to reverse. You're not going to have a lot of new bone growth and repair of that. But a lot of the other things will reverse. So they need to be aware while you're on the steroids, you're going to look real funky. You know, you have a lot of bruises, you're going to have a fistria, these stretch marks like that. Those may never go away either. Anyway, so this is Cushing's syndrome, and the question is, why do you have Cushing's syndrome? Are you taking exogenous? Do you even know what you're taking? Is it production of ACTH from up here, driving the pituitary, or driving the adrenal? Does the adrenal have an autonomously functioning tumor of its own, or is the ACTH coming from someplace else? Lung cancer, small cell carcinoma of the lung can produce ACTH. And have exactly this picture right here. Even testicular tumors, we'll talk about that in a week, can cause that. So when we see something that looks like this, we make the distinction between Cushing's syndrome, which is a collection of findings, and Cushing's disease. What Cushing actually described was pituitary adenoma. Well, in fact, when we take a look at non-medicinally induced, that is the most common one. We have a small so-called microadenoma that's producing just a little tiny bit of ACTH more than you need, not a lot. You probably are aware that we have a diurnal variation of cortisol in the bloodstream, is that right? Most of us, God only knows for students when you're up all night and that kind of thing, but let's just say an average person, when does it peak and when does it trough? When does it bad flows? It peaks at what? In the morning, afternoon, evening? It peaks about 4 a.m. For most of us, it's at its height at about 4 a.m. and it's at the lowest at 4 p.m. All you have to do to create a person who looks like this, okay? All you have to do is remove that trough. If they had a constant level of cortisol, so whatever their peak level is, give them a month and they're going to look like that, 2 months and like that. That's all. It doesn't take a whole buttload of this stuff, right? All you have to have is this unremitting, very small stimulation of ACTH, and you're going to end up looking like that because it never stops. Whereas normally it goes up and comes back down, so on average it's half of the level that you think that, you know, the peak. All you have to do is just have a constant level of what is your peak. And so looking at just that, the doctor goes and gets a blood sample and says, well, let's just take a look and see what your level is, and it may come up in basically the reference range, or certainly the reference range for an AM sample as opposed to a PM sample. But on the other hand, I might say, well, that's not that high, what's the deal here? So what we have to do in a lot of these cases is collect the urine for 24 hours, and we're going to look at the total amount of output over a 24-hour period, because we want to see what the whole shtick was for the whole day. Because again, the serum level may not be very high. It's just that it does not do this. It just stays high with constant stimulation. So I've listed here some of the things that can lead to that. Autonomously functioning tumors of the adrenal itself, so on. Here's an example of that. Two examples. Here we're taking a look at a tumor of the adrenal. Here you can see the adrenal cortex right there. Here's the medulla, and here's the tumor. Here, on the other hand, that's a normal adrenal up here. Here, we're taking a look at one that had ACTH stimulation. Unremitted, not long, not real high, but just unremitted, never stopped. It's just enough, you know.
Kind of like when your roommate just sort of, you know, they won't turn the TV down.
It's not a bad rock, but it just won't be real long. And eventually, you brought me a shoe.
what are you supposed to do? I mean, let's get real.
It's just enough when I'm nauseous. And this is what happens right here when you have unremitting stimulation. And again, it's not astronomically high levels of ACT. We'll emphasize that. Okay, so that is one that would be driven from here. And here could be exactly the same picture, clinical picture we looked at a moment ago, driven from the adrenal cortex itself. And again, just to restate, you can have ectopic ACTH stimulation coming from a small cell carcinoma, so there are a variety of reasons for that. But again, the most common cause for that picture would be exogenous steroids we're giving the person to help with something out of autoimmune disease or part of cancer chemotherapy. Now, hyperaldosteronism is Kahn's syndrome, goes by that name. And it's not quite as clear cut in many cases here what's causing it, whether it's an adenoma or a generalized hyperplasia. It's only about 65%. So about two-thirds of the time, it is an adenoma arising in this case, the zona glomerulosa. It's producing lots of aldosterone. Person is hypotensive because they're retaining lots of sodium. They drink a lot. Because we're exchanging, you're wanting to recover sodium. You've got to get rid of some positive ion, so you're going to either get rid of potassium, calcium, or hydrogen. So they're alkalotic as a rule. They have high serum or high urinary potassiums, and almost always they're sort of alkalotic, which to say they'll be running a pH, blood pH, of around 7.5 or something. What this is showing here is a masseter spasm, and it hurts like hell. You do that once just to see if you can make it happen, and they don't want you ever doing it again. And that's probably related actually to the calcium. They lose the calcium again because what you're doing is they're trying to retain, aldosterone is saying, give me that sodium back, and I'm going to give you some positive charge. If I can give you one calcium, that's two positive charges, I get two sodiums for the price of one, right? So from a biological standpoint, it makes more sense to get rid of that. But we're getting rid of any positive thing, potassium, calcium, and hydrogen. To retain all that sodium, which is going to expand the vascular volume. This is a curable form of hypertension. And so we take out that adrenal, take out that tumor, and everything's going to be fine. And it is. And everything goes back to being pretty good. Now you can have congenital, I mentioned congenital abnormalities, and which have an interesting side effect, and that is the most common thing you can be born with is a 21 beta hydroxylase deficiency. Now let me just say that estrogen, progesterone, I remind you of this, estrogen, progesterone, cortisol, these are all glorified cholesterols. So they're a lipid, right? Okay. So at any rate, they're glorified lipids, so they're carried on a protein. They're transported on a protein. You can't really get, chicken fat comes to the top of the dish, comes to the top of the pot, and so will cholesterol. So they're transported on protein. My point here is that developing in utero, there's not a lot of maternal gift of cortisol, not a maternal gift of estrogen, progesterone, and so forth, testosterone, to develop in the fetus. Kids got to make it on its own because mom's is all bound to protein because it's a lipid. And that's how you get it, move it around in a water system of blood. If the kid has 21 beta hydroxylase deficiency, what will happen is that he has a low cortisol. So you got a low cortisol out here, and you can't make aldosterone. If you can't make cortisol, what's the pituitary? What's that developing kid's pituitary going to do? It's going to release ACTH and say, hey, bring that cortisol on. What are you taking a break down there? But of course, it can't do anything because we're missing this enzyme. But it keeps pounding on that adrenal to release it, but it can't do it. However, if we're driving the system here, one thing that will happen is we'll have a lot of exogen, a lot of extra testosterone produced. And so kids are born with very ambiguous genitalia. Little girls will have a very large clitoris that looks like a small penis. labia will effuse, so it looks like a small scrotal sac and so on. The other thing that they'll have, since they can't make all the serum, they have real problems with maintaining blood pressure. So kids can be born with this, and these are known as a salt-losing androgenizing effect. 21-beta-hydroxylase is the most frequent one. And this actually is extremely easy to fix. They unfortunately, the ambiguous genitalia are not, and they require surgery. But in this case, it's very easy to fix. How would you correct this problem? We're going to give them the enzyme, or are we going to put it in a gene and take the gene out and put it in a virus, inject it in the kid, and say, blah. What do we have to do to turn off this crazy stimulation? Yeah. What we're going to do is we're going to give what they can't produce. We're going to give them cortisol and all the serum. And you put them on the pill, you regulate that, and you shut off the ACT production, and bang, the testosterone level goes back to where it should be. And everything is fine. Of course, you're going to be on this the rest of lives, but it is actually easy to circumvent that because you can give them what they were not able to produce. Now, another form of hypoadrenalism is something that occurs catastrophically. This will happen periodically here. Yeah.
Is there no way of knowing in utero whether the baby is having to?
Actually, there is. Now, you've got to be of a certain size. If you have an ultrasound that can look at any kind of abdominal, anything like that, you will know whether you're dealing with male or female beyond just simply looking for the labia or small penis or something. And if it gets to be ambiguous, many times you can't really tell.
There's nothing you can really do.
No. Well, I don't know, but there might be. Here we're looking at catastrophic adrenal failure. I mentioned infections, bacterial infections occasionally. This is the kind of thing we see with meningococcus. It's a reason, basically, you really want to be immunized against these so-called encapsulated organisms of meningococcus and strep and pneumococcus, because they will cause this. And it's in situations like this where people come together from all over the country. They're in a dormitory together. They go back at Christmas time. They come back to this thing in the throat. They start around. And next thing you know, we got two people in the hospital who look like this and are dying. This is an overwhelming infection with meningococcus. It's called Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. And all the splotches on here have to do with the fact that that meningococcal organism likes to live in the endothelial cells. And it has caused vascular rupture and bleed in the tissue. It's also caused it here, and it may be causing meningitis. This person would die. But anyway, one thing we will see here will be hemorrhagic destruction of the adrenal. And when that happens, we've got to replace those glucocorticoids very quickly. And you might think we don't want to put them on a lot. We're trying to get them to fight the infection, but it's actually just the other way around. So in this case, we see with hypoadrenalism, are we looking at chronic versus acute loss? And in this case, this is acute. This happens in a matter of a couple of hours. The most common thing is Addison's disease, which is not an infection, or can be actually worldwide, certainly can be. But we can see Addison's disease, and this would be an example of that. Again, it occurs more frequently in women than men, and this just happens to be the case with all autoimmune diseases, especially endocrine-related ones. And what we're looking at here is a person, and I remember seeing this one gal who was just unbelievably fit appearing. She was probably in her 30s. She was brought in to see us when I was a student. She had a tan. She looked like she'd just gotten off the tennis court. She had kind of a sweater sort of looped over like this. You know, she just looked the part of a wealthy person who'd just gotten back from a vacation someplace in the sun. Told us her story, how tired she was, how weak she was, and so forth. And when she tried to stand up and leave, she passed out. Okay, that's the story of Addison's disease. What you've done is you've lost this adrenal gland. You may have lots of ACTH trying to stimulate the adrenal, but the adrenal is gone. The most common event that occurs to cause this destruction around here is autoimmune in nature. Once again, it's an old song. If we have autoimmune disease of one kind, you've got to be on the lookout maybe years down the road, you're on the lookout for another one. Why would they be hyperpigmented? Do you think she spent any time under a sun lamp? Why does she have such nice pigmentation? In fact, the pigmentation can be outrageous. You'll see a pigmenting under the fingernails, which none of us have. You'll see pigmented mucosa. So what is happening to the agency of Pittsburgh because there's so much causing all that? Where does ACTH come from? It comes off as one long noodle of a protein. What else is with that noodle? And then we cleave it. One part of it is active in terms of stimulating the adrenal. Is the rest of it trash? No, it's MSH. Okay. So when we're producing lots of ACTH, well, we're being driven from the hypothalamus. Produce lots and lots of ACTH. We also get MSH with it, so we're stimulating melanocytes. Hence the hyperpigmentation. Although the pituitary really doesn't have any control over zonal amylosa and aldosterone production, we still have hypotension because cortisol also kind of helps retain sodium. And in fact, when we see somebody with Cushing's disease, you might have noticed that hypertension was one of the side effects, one of the elements in that. Sounds like a TB ward in here. What's going on? All right. Speaking of TB, worldwide, tuberculosis is actually the most common cause of this. Here in the United States, we never see it. If someone came in with that right now, I'm guaranteed we'd have to answer. But worldwide, tuberculosis is TB loves delivering the immune glands that can go there. And worldwide, tuberculosis, as you know, is an extremely common infection. And that destruction from that in Central Africa, Asia, and so forth is the main reason for Addison's disease there. You can have metastatic cancer, particularly from the GI tract, especially the stomach, that might involve it and cause destruction as well. Now, occasionally we see tumors of the adrenal medulla. Adrenal medulla, and this is a kidney right here, cut in section, and here's a great big tumor on top of it, and it's a pheochromocytoma. Pheochromocytomas are coming from the adrenal medulla or medullary tissue. It might be interesting to know that about 10% of the adrenal medullary tissue is not in the adrenal. It's typically around some of the blood vessels in that area. So it's possible to have a pheochromocytoma outside of the adrenal. These things normally produce our catecholamines, are part of that flight or fright response. Right? What are the basic elements of flight or fright? I'm talking about food, right? There are four Fs or something like that. Flight, fright, food, and sex or something. All right. Anyway, that is what's driving, it is that epinephrine surge, the catecholamine surge, a mixture of both epinephrine and norepinephrine is driving that. In this case, it brings up our blood pressure, and what you have is episodic release. One of the interesting aspects of this, because this thing does not release it continuously, what has to happen is bits and pieces of it die. And then the cells release the epinephrine they've got in there. So there's this episodic release. And people complain of intermittent headaches, nosebleeds, they may have anxiety attacks, and they'll pass out. And you might think, excuse me, high blood pressure, and they pass out. What goes on here? What happens is that their vessels kind of become adapted to these sudden bursts of epinephrine. And then when the epinephrine disappears, they relax. And when they relax, if they're standing up, all the blood goes to your legs, and you get lightheaded and pass out. So these so-called syncopal episodes, or passing out episodes, which would seem to be counterintuitive with something that causes increase in blood pressure. But the increase in blood pressure is episodic. It occurs when you have a release of that from bits and pieces that die. Pheochromocytomas would be a curable form of high blood pressure. And it's the kind of thing, actually, that I'd be very careful in surgery. I got a newspaper yesterday from sort of my alternate hometown out in the Puget Sound area, and I noticed that somebody died during surgery. It's a pretty unusual thing. Generally, it's a problem of either maintaining body temperature or having some catastrophic event take place where high or low blood pressure occurs. And because fiddling around with a pheochromocytoma, if you're in there doing surgery and messing with it, the anesthesiologist needs to know that, and they are very cautious of what's going to happen if there's this huge epinephrine release, and all of a sudden their blood pressure shoots up to 300 and they blow out a couple vessels in their head. And so what we do is when you're going to do a surgery, the first thing they do is they very cautiously go around and tie off all the veins. because you don't want to tie off an artery and have the thing actually undergo infarction and release lots of epinephrine. So they tie off all the veins so that whatever happens next, the blood can't leave it. And you don't end up suddenly having this incredible wash of catecholamines into the vascular system during surgery. I listed some things in the notes about pheochromocytomas. You kind of want to take a look at those, please. Now, we've made a deal here about the fact that the endocrine system really does look like it's sort of put together after the fact. We've kind of got an organism. We've got to take these neurocrust derivative cells. They've got to migrate all over the place. They're going to populate the interstitial cells, and they're going to come down in the thyroid. They're going to end up here. They're going to end up in the adrenal medulla. They're going to end up in the GI tract. They're going to end up in the bronchial system and so forth. And they go all over the place. It's sort of like after, you know, the good Lord got done sort of planning this out and said, you know what, I didn't realize they were going to get this big. We've got to figure out plan B. And so you got all kinds of modifications of the endocrine system. One of these is this business of having neurocrust derivative cells migrate around and populate organs and become, in the end, like the beta cells and the gastrin secreting cells in the pancreas and the islets of Langerhans. Well, if you have an inherited condition or there's a somatic mutation that occurs very early in development in utero, let's say at the four cell stage, that would be kind of odd, wouldn't it? I mean, 2, 4, 6, whatever. New math, I can't keep up with it. But you will have, if you have a mutation that occurs either in utero or it is something that's carried in your family and passed on, you might have a problem with your neurocrust derivative cell. And therefore, every place that those guys go are going to carry that potential problem with them. And so we occasionally see conditions, and we have a kindred of it here in the south, on the south end of Monroe County, who have a condition known as multiple endocardial plasia. There are two very basic versions of this, and there are two different genes that do it, and it is a mutation in neurocrust derivative cells. And when they migrate around then, they end up populating the parathyroids, they end up populating the interstitial cells of the thyroid, wherever they go. And if you're going to have tumors develop, which is what happens, you're going to have develop in a lot of places. And it's going to seem disconnected, but it is connected if you understand these were all neurocrust derivative basically ended up in those places. So multiple endocrine neoplasia is a condition in which we have something like that. The first one is called Vermeer syndrome. My favorite, Dean Vermeer, who passed away about 2 years ago. Being in Animal House, if you might recall. If you haven't seen the movie, I highly recommend it. Last year, I went on a little trek. I wanted to go where they filmed it. So I went to Eugene, Oregon, which is where they filmed it, went to all the sites, you know, got my picture taken on the steps of the places. But anyway, Dean Vermeer, there's, it's called Vermeer syndrome. He didn't have it, but anyway, it's MEN1. This is a tumor suppressor gene. And what we see with this is called the P-cube syndrome. And these are not necessarily malignant tumors. In fact, they're not malignant tumors. They're benign tumors. Parathyroid adenomas, pancreatic islet adenomas, and pituitary adenomas. Well, it doesn't have to be malignant to kill you. If you have pancreatic islet adenomas, and one of those is an insulin-secreting tumor, and it releases lots of insulin, and you're driving home, your insulin comes out for whatever reason, no reason at all, all of a sudden your blood sugar drops, you know, down around your socks. The next thing you know, you're unconscious, you drive off and hit an abutment, you're dead, you're still dead. All right. Just the fact that it's a benign tumor doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't have really serious consequences. The tumors that we see in the pituitary gland with MEN type 1 most often are, again, benign, and they don't produce anything other than prolactin. They read the book on that one. But again, if you've got a growing tumor in the adrenal, in the anterior pituitary, there's not a lot of room up there. That sits in that little celotursic and that little, you know, saddle up in there. And if it grows and grows, it's going to squeeze the crap out of the rest of the gland. The rest of the gland is going to die. And you're going to have downstream failure of everything else. because the adenoma squished to death. So the fact that it's either not making anything or maybe making prolactin is immaterial, it's the presence of the tumor. Parathyroid adenomas, pancreatic islet, you know,
they're benign in the sense that they're not going to metastasize, although people originally thought, what's causing this thing? Is this really metastasis of something? And then the answer is, no, it's not. MEN2, there are a couple of variances of this, by the way, and MEN2 is a slightly different one. Now, this is the one that we do want to be careful, because this does have cancer, which will kill you, and that's why whenever we see somebody with a medullary carcinoma with thyroid, we want to leap on that, and often we'll go take a look at their extended family to see if anybody else has it. And it's a good thing. Pathologists, you know, we got boat payments to make, all this kind of stuff. We want to do a lot of work over the lab, so it's scary. That's not like it. All right. The pheochromocytomas, yes, sir, you can definitely blow out a blood vessel with that. So the type 2
is the one that has the cancer and might be, and that would be the thyroid cancer. This is showing some of the, what it is, the protein that's involved, and I don't understand it, so I'm going to get off that picture. The 2B has an interesting thing is in that they have lots of, they may also have neurofibromas, and this person has a neurofibroma here that can be all over the place, and they may have changes in the eyes that are so-called iris pigmentation areas called Lish nodules. I mentioned it here, and I just will go back to this for a moment, and that is the idea of the pancreatic islet cell tumors. And that is, they can be of any stripe. Again, the islets, the pancreas is a composite organ. The digestive part of that arises from the endoderm. It comes from GI epithelium that gives rise to the liver. It also gives rise to the exocrine portion, which is making digestive enzymes. The islets of Langerhans, of course, fly in there. Those cells come in there. Those are neurocrest derivative cells. And they can produce, depending on what they eventually become, they're either beta cells that are producing glucose, they may be delta cells, I believe they're delta cells, I mean, let's see if it is, producing gastrin that's causing acid release. And again, you want acid release when you've got something in the stomach only. You don't want to produce a lot of acid all the time. So it kind of makes sense to have the pancreas involved here in producing gastrin. If you have a gastrin secreting tumor, these people have lots and lots of ulcers. GI ulcers because of the high acid secretion. I use the word intractable, meaning you can't get rid of them. You can't. It doesn't seem like you do whatever you can and the ulcers recur. You never get better. You can have glucagon secreting adenomas. Those are pretty unusual. I will say that this is pretty much the sequence in terms of frequency that we see them, either beta cell, delta cell, or alpha cell. So these are generally benign. I will have to say that most of the tumors that arise in the islets of Langerhans do occur just on their own. They're sporadic. They're not part of the multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1. So anybody can develop one of these. And I saw a person who had diabetes. She was on insulin for a while. And then she started having insulin reactions, like her blood sugar would get real low. And so she started just decreasing her insulin on her own. And eventually she went and told her doctor, I'm cured. My blood sugars are staying fine and I don't need this. And then she started having insulin reactions on no insulin. It turns out she had an islet cell tumor in the pancreas. Unfortunately, it was malignant. Only about 10% of these are malignant, and it had already spread in her belly. So anyway, this will be taking a look at another kind of endocrine tumor that we might see either as part of familial syndrome, more frequently not, and it can have very serious consequences, life-threatening consequences in terms of ulcers and holes in your stomach and bleeding and sudden drops in insulin and so on, or in glucose, rather. So, and that's it for now. All right. Any questions? I'll see you on Tuesday. I'll tell you how Tuesday goes and never get done what I have to do in 2 hours. 1 hour is going to be male reproductive. 1 hour is going to be female reproductive. I'm supposed to fit breast diseases into that as well. And what has always happened every year is that the back of my office will be 15 to 20 minutes with the breast disease. We'll see how we do on Tuesday, a week from now.
And just remember that this is going to be allowable loser of a test coming up on the 8th. So I'm sorry about that, but that's all. I will get you some questions, sample questions. I was asked to send 50, which I did. They're going to be cut down. I saw you got an email, and SP said 40, but I sent 50, so he's going to cut some out. I tried to make him roughly the equivalent. How much time did we spend on each thing? And that's what I tried to do, is stick to that. Tried to stay actually with about 10 questions, 8 to 10 questions for each unit that we've done. Okay, but what's going to end up on the test, I'm not quite sure. Thank you all.